Good afternoon. First things first, I thought I might make reference to the fact that I am not Tom Bramali, so I can't do this off the top of my head the way he does. He knows these things inside out, so I've had to do a lot of homework, and I'll be referring to notes I've taken over the last week on this particular sutta. It's one that I find I get a lot of hope from, because it's the one, the only one, and I think I've read them all, that kind of gives you a path about how, I'll start at the beginning. We're doing two suttas, one of which is sort of a preface to the other one. The first one I'll do, which is called Molyapugala Sutta, and in it, the Buddha is explaining to a disciple how things arise and pass away, and the fact that there is no agent. There's no agent. It all has to do with causes and conditions that bring certain phenomena into existence. And with that as a beginning, then we'll go on to because that deals with something called the dependent origination, which is a schematic which I've drawn. I did a little drawing myself, which apparently somebody else did a much better job of and had the same idea. So if everybody has one of these, it's probably a lot more useful than the one that I did, which was pretty amateurish. Yeah, that one there, that's mine, and it's, yeah, very amateurish. But it says the same thing, but this one is a little bit easier to read. It has to do, dependent origination has to do with how the universe works, how life works. And it begins, I mentioned yesterday, it begins with ignorance. And it actually doesn't begin with ignorance. Ignorance is always there. There is no, I'll read from something. In Buddhism, there is no such teaching as a first cause. It's something that almost every other religion accepts, the fact that something, there was a beginning somewhere. And it's something that the Buddha said, there is no discernible beginning. He didn't say there wasn't one, but he just said it's not discernible. I've always taken that as, I'm quite happy with the fact that there was no beginning. But within this context, ignorance seems to be the overriding, it's kind of an umbrella, and it covers everything. It affects everything that happens subsequent to it. Anyway. In Buddhism, there's no teaching of a first cause. How all this arising and ceasing began, or even if it had a beginning, is not explained. The Buddha emphasized understanding the nature of things as they are. He emphasized it over speculation of what might have happened in the past or what might happen in the future. It might be said that the Buddhist version of Genesis, the Christian idea of how things all began, the Buddhist version is stuff happens because other stuff happens. And I think that's as good a shorthand as I've ever run across. It's also things in the way that things are the way they are because they are conditioned by other things. They are conditioned by other people and phenomena. Other people and phenomena are conditioned by you. Now this, in my drawing, there's a circle. That circle there. Now that's the one that we're most familiar with. That's normal, kind of normal dependent origination, and it covers ignorance, suffering, birth, existence, clinging, craving, feeling, contact, the six sense bases, name and form, consciousness, comic formations, and ignorance. Now this seems kind of linear, and I have a different sense of this. I don't think that it's linear at all. I think it's more like a matrix where everything that in that circle is constantly interacting with every other one and affecting it. And it's not necessarily just two-dimensional either. I would say it's probably four-dimensional. And so this is quite a simplified, I think this is essentially just a pedagogical tool. This is just a way of making a little bit of sense of something that it takes a profound amount of understanding to really come to grips with it. The Buddha said, "This, what you need to know to become an enlightened being, or once you become an enlightened being, you understand this, is this dependent origination of the Four Noble Truths." They tend to parallel each other. And anyway, so we'll... we'll do that later. So we'll begin with a reading of the Moliya Pugala, which will give you an idea of what the Buddha is saying. At Sawati, bhikkhus, there are these four kinds of... Oh, at Sawati, he said, bhikkhus, there are these four kinds of nutriment. Now, ignoring a few things that you don't understand, like nutriment is kind of an essential teaching, but it's not necessary to understand what it is I'm trying to get from this sutta. Bhikkhus, there are these four kinds of nutriment for the maintenance of beings that have already come to be and for the assistance of those about to come to be. What for? The nutriment, edible food, gross or subtle. Second, contact. Third, mental volition. Fourth, consciousness. These are the four kinds of nutriment for the maintenance of beings that have already come to be and for the assistance of those about to come to be. When this was said, the Venerable Moliya Pugala said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, who consumes the nutriment for consciousness?" "Not a valid question," the Buddha replied. "I do not say one consumes. If I should say one consumes, in that case, this would be a valid question. Venerable Sir, who consumes? But I do not speak thus. Since I do not speak thus, if one should ask me, Venerable Sir, for what is the nutriment consciousness a condition? This would be a valid question. To this, the valid answer is, the nutriment consciousness is a condition for the production of future renewed existence, or bhava on this circle. When that which has come into being exists, the six sense bases come to be, with the six sense bases as condition, contact." He's going through the circle here, but he's saying that nobody's doing this. He's saying that because one exists, the next one exists. It's not just a one-way thing. As I say, it's a matrix, and each one that affects the following one, there will be a reciprocal reaffecting of the previous one. But what he's trying to do is eliminate the idea of an agent. And anyway, so, "Venerable Sir, who makes contact?" "Not a valid question," the Blessed One replied. "I do not say one makes contact. Since I do not speak thus, one should ask me, Venerable Sir, what as condition does contact come to be? This would be a valid question. To this, the valid answer is, with the six sense bases as condition, contact comes to be. With contact as condition, feeling." So again, coming back to the circle, he's going back and forth between feeling and that, but nobody's actually doing it. This kind of begs the question of what philosophers in Christianity have all have been kicking around for thousands of years about free will. And if you take this at face value, it kind of eliminates that. There's a monk of some considerable seniority who I heard in England say that we have about, of all the things that we are and can do, only about 1/7 is not comically determined. You have a 1/7 of what you do, you actually have some degree of control over. You can will certain things. I've never heard anybody use a fraction before, and I don't know how accurate he is, but he's got some rank, so it's possible. But I think that one has to assume that when these things do occur, my sense is that there is something besides just conditionality. But I know that people who are wiser than I say that sense is a misperception of reality. It's what Ajahn Brahm calls a vipalasa. It's a perversion of perception, and it could be. And anyway, I'll get around to where we diverge into the next sutta, because this is where it comes up. Because you here in the second sutta that we're doing, there appears to be a point where we make a choice, and by definition here we can't make any choices. It's all subject to the conditions that existed prior. "Venerable Sir, who feels?" "Not a valid question. I do not say one feels. Since I do not speak thus, if one should ask, Venerable Sir, with what as condition does feeling come to be? This would be a valid question. To this, the valid answer is, with contact as condition, feeling comes to be. With feeling as condition, craving." So Venerable Sir, who craves? He's still trying to point out, he's still trying to say, who is it that's doing all this? And he says, not a valid question. I do not say one craves. I say with, since I do not speak thus, if one should ask me, Venerable Sir, with what as condition does craving come to be? This would be a valid question, to which the valid answer is, with feeling as condition, craving comes to be. With craving as condition, clinging. With clinging as condition, existence. Such is the origin of this whole massive suffering. But Paguna, with a remainderless fading away and cessation of the six bases for contact, and then he runs through this whole thing and saying, ending in pain, lamentation, grief, and despair, they cease. This is the cessation of the whole mass of suffering. Now, there does, in this sutta, he doesn't go into any method for ending this. This is the circle in which this occurs. And when I first encountered this Upanisa Sutta, which is the next one we're doing, now, I hope you'll forgive me for not being a little bit more detailed about this, but I hope I get the idea across that essentially what this sutta is saying is that there's nobody doing anything that you're doing. You're not in charge of this. This is something that is predetermined by the previous conditions. So I'm going to borrow heavily from Bhikkhu Bodhi, who did a brilliant breakdown of this particular sutta. But bear with me one second. I think that's what I want to say. Right, okay. Now, tucked away in the Sanyutta Nikaya among the connected sayings on causality, which is what you have in your hand, is a short formalized text entitled the Upanisa Sutta, the Discourse on Supporting Conditions. Though at first glance hardly conspicuous among many interesting suttas in this collection, this little discourse turns out upon repeated examination to be of tremendous doctrinal importance. Its great significance derives from the striking juxtaposition it makes of two applications of dependent arising. That's the one that is normally referred to, and that's the one that Ajahn Brahmi always talks about and knows inside out. And most monks and most teachers refer to that. This item up here, which is the one that emerges from the side of this particular circle, which is the same as the circle that I've drawn, comes out of here. And this is one that is not ignored, but it's he explains why this seems to be sort of downplayed. Its great significance derives from the striking juxtaposition it makes of two applications of dependent arising, the principle of conditionality which lies at the heart of the Buddha's doctrine. The first application is the usual one, setting forth the causal sequence responsible for the origination of samsaric suffering. The second application of dependent arising allows the same principle of conditionality to structure the path leading to deliverance from suffering. It begins with faith, emerging out of suffering, with which the first series ended. Now, actually, what happens in the first series, this series usually ends in old age, sickness, and death. But when the Buddha rephrases this in this sutta, he changes old age, sickness, and death to suffering, which is essentially what old age, sickness, and death is. But he uses suffering as a jumping off point, and here is where I say it's a little strange, because here it seems that we are able to make a choice. It begins with faith, emerging out of suffering with which the first series ended, and continues through the retrospective knowledge of liberation, which confirms the destruction of the binding defilements. By linking the two series into a single sequence, the sutta reveals the entire course of man's faring in the world, as well as his treading of the path to its transcendence. It shows, moreover, that these two dimensions of human experience, the mundane, that one, and the transcendental, which is the one that's going to get you all out of what you're trying to get out of, are both governed by a single structural principle, that of dependent arising. Recognizing this broader range of principle, the netipakarana, we'll skip that. That's not necessary. So the sutta itself says, while staying at Sawati, the exalted one said, the destructions of the cankers, he calls it cankers, they can be called taints or asavas. They're not defilements, they're a specific category of things you don't want, and they're called the asavas, but the taints is better. The destruction of the taints, monks, is for one who knows and sees. I say not for one who does not know and see. Knowing what, seeing what, of the taints occur. Such is material form, such as material form, where are we? Material form. Wait a minute. Material form, such as feeling. Needless to say, I've had to do some homework. Material form, jati, feeling. Oh, there we go, Pasen, that's contact. Sorry, I'm just going to have to keep reading. Such as the material form, such as the arising material form, such as the passing away of material form, such as feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness, such as the arising of consciousness, such as the passing away of consciousness. For one who knows and sees this, monks, the destruction of the taints occurs. Now, he's skipping a couple while he's doing this. He's doing a bit of a shorthand for this particular lower mundane order of dependent arising. The knowledge of destruction with respect to destruction has a supporting condition. Now we got to sort of start at the top now because he goes backwards. The knowledge of destruction with respect to destruction has a supporting condition. Now this is one where I have a little difficulty too because the second from the end is liberation. That's destruction of the taints. There seems to be another stage beyond that, which is an understanding that you've already reached that. It strikes me as kind of unnecessary, but again, wiser people than mine than I have rigged up this way. So we go backwards. Destruction does not lack a supporting condition. And what is a supporting condition for the knowledge of destruction? Emancipation. That's vimutti. Emancipation, monks, also has a supporting condition. I say it does not lack a supporting condition. And what is a supporting condition for emancipation? Dispassion, viraga, should be the reply. Dispassion, monks, also has a supporting condition. I say it does not lack a supporting condition. And what is a supporting condition for dispassion? Disenchantment, nibbida, should be the reply. Dispassion, monks, also has a supporting condition. I say it does not lack a supporting condition. And what is the supporting condition for dispassion? Disenchantment should be, where are we, disenchantment? No, sorry, nibbida is disenchantment. Yeah, nibbida is disenchantment. And what is the supporting condition for dispassion? Disenchantment. Disenchantment, monks, also has a supporting condition. It does not lack a supporting condition. And what is the supporting condition for disenchantment? The knowledge and vision of things as they really are. Now, from here on, you're actually dealing with the insight side of meditation. From knowledge of things as they are, all the way to the destruction of the taints, is what you tackle when you take on Vipassana meditation. That's the second aspect of meditative practice. The first aspect is, of course, samadhi. That's what we're trying to work toward, most of us anyway, which begins with samadhi, or which ends with samadhi. We're working in this direction, but the Buddha, for some reason, is working it backwards. The knowledge of vision of things as they really are, monks, does not lack a supporting condition. What is a supporting condition? What is the supporting condition for knowledge and vision of the things as they really are? Concentration, samadhi. Concentration, monks, also has a supporting condition. I say it does not lack a supporting condition. And what is the supporting condition for concentration? Happiness should be the reply, sukha. Happiness, monks, also has a supporting condition. I say it does not lack a supporting condition. And what is the supporting condition for happiness? Tranquility should be the reply. That's pasada. Tranquility, monks, has a supporting condition. Rapture, that's piti. That's, again, within your samadhi practice, that's what you are kind of aiming for. That's probably your first step. Rapture, monks, has a supporting condition. It does not lack a supporting condition. Joy should be the reply. Joy has a supporting condition. And what is the supporting condition for joy? Faith. Faith, monk, has a supporting condition. It does not lack a supporting condition. And what is a supporting condition for faith? Suffering. Suffering has a supporting condition. It does not lack a supporting condition. What is a supporting condition for suffering? Birth. Now, we're going to stop there because he goes on to this particular circle here. And so it goes back through birth and, where are we, birth, existence. Boy. I've done this backwards. This is too bad. My apologies. Thus, monks, ignorance is a supporting condition for kama formations. Okay, here we go. This is this is a shorthand for this particular one. And he does this three different times, but in three different directions, which makes it a little bit difficult. Ignorance is a supporting condition for comma formations, and this comma formations are a supporting condition for consciousness. Yesterday, I was a little bit uncertain about that. I thought the order should be reversed, but comma formations, which I thought you needed consciousness to precede, the comma formations they're talking about are comma formations from a previous life, and so they are the things that actually support consciousness in this life. So consciousness is a supporting condition for mentality, materiality. Mentality, materiality is a supporting condition for the sixfold sense base. Sixfold sense base is a supporting condition for contact, and on down through the line, contact, feeling, craving, clinging, existence, birth, and suffering. Suffering is a supporting condition for faith. So he works his way all the way around back here to what was in the original circle, old age, sickness, and death, and he changes it to suffering. Where are we? Okay. Okay. Birth is a supporting condition for suffering. Suffering is supporting. Now, okay, we're going to go backwards now. Suffering is the condition for faith. Faith is the condition for faith is supporting condition for joy. Joy is a supporting condition for rapture. Rapture is the supporting condition for tranquility. Tranquility is a supporting condition for happiness. Happiness is a supporting condition for concentration. Concentration is a supporting condition for knowledge and vision of the things they are as they really are. The knowledge and vision of things as they really are is a supporting condition for disenchantment. Disenchantment is a supporting condition for dispassion. Dispassion is a supporting condition for emancipation. And emancipation is a supporting condition for the knowledge of the destruction of the taints. Okay, that's what the sutta says. And it's not an easy thing to understand, particularly the way I read it. So if you take on simply the fact that the main thrust of his argument is the fact that we aren't really in charge of any of this. The clinging, the craving, the existence, the birth, and all that is nothing to do with what we consider our individual selves. He came up with, on the night of his enlightenment, an understanding that there was no that's what anatta is all about. There is no abiding, there's no soul, there's no abiding self that is actually making decisions. I'm going to carry on reading from him, but I'll be deleting quite a bit of stuff that I think is not necessary. Dependent arising, which is this conditionality, is the central principle of the Buddha, constituting both the objective content of its liberating insight and the germinative source for its vast network of doctrines and disciplines. As the frame behind the Four Noble Truths, the key to the perspective of the Middle Way, and the conduit to the realization of selflessness, it is the unifying theme running through the teachings' multifarious expressions, binding them together as diversified formulas of a single coherent vision, which is, if this is, that is. With the arising of this, that arises. With the cessation of this, that ceases to exist. It's almost not necessarily just Dhamma. It's logic. It's just the way I've always seen life. And I've taught a lot of prisoners who will read stuff like this, not quite so intricate stuff as this, but they say, that's how I thought about things. And it's always kind of, and you know, it's liberating to have somebody who knows nothing about Buddhism to say, this is logic. So the Pali texts present dependent arising in a double form. And that's what this is. This is two forms. This is the first mundane level, and this is the Lokutra Paticcasamuppada, which is a Pali for transcendental dependent origination. The 12-term formula disclosing the cause responsible for the origination of suffering. It begins with ignorance, the primary root of the series, though not a first cause. Again, there is no first cause. Ignorance is always there. It's something into which we're born and with which we die, and then we carry on to a next life, and ignorance is always there. But if you somehow or other make, sort of take a detour, there seems to be a point here at just before ignorance where old age, sickness, and death is sort of rephrased as suffering, and suffering then allows you to begin the path, which begins with faith. And There's the Buddha said when suffering gets great enough, there are two escapes, one of which is intoxication, and the other of which is search. And that's what we're all involved in here, I believe. Certainly I am. The Pali tradition has focused upon the doctrine of almost exclusively in terms of its 12-fold formulation. That's here. So much has this been the case, the two have tended to be blankly identified, dependent arising being equated simply with the 12-fold series, and the 12-fold series being regarded as an exhaustive treatment of dependent arising. This is unfortunate because I think it doesn't allow us to see any hope. It just says you die, you're born again, and the whole series continues on and on and on. But we have fortunately encountered a teaching that permits of a release from this, but it's a release that requires a considerable degree of practice and work. And I mentioned yesterday, it's the most significant work it's the most significant thing anybody can do with his life is to try and escape this circle. It's not just tedious, it's harmful. Everything that's wrong with life can be subsumed under this particular circle. Dependent arising remains an expression of the invariable structural relatedness of phenomena. It is a principle to which all phenomena conform by the very nature of their being. The principle that whatever comes to existence does so independent on conditions, not from some intrinsic nature of their own, from necessity, chance, or accident, but from their causal correlation to each other. The present sequence views the same chain of events, this here, dynamically from the inner perspective of living experience. Okay, this here is almost theoretical. This here is something you actually do, or is not done for you either. It comes to be. Okay, I've got to get rid of the you in that. But it's a sequence that comes to be because of conditions that somehow or other have, not magically, but fortuitously come into being, which permits a departure from this boring circle of existence down here to one that leads to the ending of suffering. As living experience, the advance to an emancipation cannot be tied down to a mere series of negations, which is all this is, for such a mode of treatment omits precisely what is most essential to the spiritual quest, the immediacy of inner striving, growth, and transformation. Now this again is what I'm getting at, is the fact that this now puts the ball kind of back in your court. You have options, I suppose, and yet even that implies a will. But as I say, the great teachers would all reply that no, this appears to be choice, but it's not. It's somehow or other that the conditions have altered slightly so that they can then be sort of transmuted onto this upper path, which takes you out of the whole mess. Where are we? Thus, the course of spiritual development, these suttas reveal, is a dependent arising, a coming into being in dependence on conditions. But this dependent arising differs significantly from its mundane counterpart. The mundane version with its 12 links describes the movement of samsara, which revolves in a perpetually self-regenerating circle, leading from beginning to end, only to find the end lead back to the beginning. The mechanism of this process by which defilements and renewed existence mutually kindle one another is fueled by the hope that somehow some solution will yet emerge within the framework of laws set for the turning of the wheel, a hope repeatedly disappointed. The present version of dependent arising delineates a type of development that only becomes possible when this hope has been dispensed with. So I guess that's what it is. You make this circle again and again and again until you get to some point where the hope that it's going to stop is eliminated, and you actually begin to see that it's going to rely entirely not on hope but on your own efforts. The prior recognition that any attempt to eliminate suffering through the gratification of craving is doomed to failure, and that the only way to stop it is to cut through the vicious nexus at its base. Though the movement is still cyclic, it is not the circular revolution of samsara it is concerned with, but a different kind of rotation that only comes into play when the essentially defective nature of ordinary human condition has been clearly perceived and the urge toward liberation from it is made the dominant motive of the inner life. The present sequence depicts the movement towards release. It sets forth a drive which, in contrast to the pointless repetition of samsara, evolves up and outwards in an unbroken spiral ascent. So we're going to get off this and we're going to get on this. Right, okay. Unlike the familiar version of dependent arising, the present version leads not back to the round of becoming, but to the overcoming of samsara and all its attendant sufferings. The process of compulsive involvement, which is the origin of suffering, the process of disengagement, which leads to the deliverance of suffering. So you're through this beginning with faith, you begin to lose the attraction of trying to beat this at its own game. Somehow or other, you figure you can do it by remaining within this circle. But this detour. You were being taught that you can't do it down here. You have to do it through this upper path. I teach only suffering. Okay. Bear with me. Okay. Where are we, faith? Okay. Okay. It begins with suffering is the supporting condition for faith. After asserting as the last step in the mundane sequence that birth is a supporting condition for suffering, the sutta switches over to the transcendental series, which is the one we're talking about, with the pronouncement that suffering is a supporting condition for faith. With respect to both assertions, the present formulation diverges from the usual version of 12-factor dependent arising. In the usual version, the forward sequence ends with a statement that birth is the condition for aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. With this, it concludes, leaving unstated the implied aftermath that this mass of suffering will generate anew the fundamental ignorance at the head of the whole series, thus beginning another run through the cycle. We are about to witness, in the progression of links to follow, not just one more turn of the wheel, but an interruption of its forward spin and a struggle to reverse its natural direction of movement. To achieve deliverance, the defilements must be removed through dispassion. To reach dispassion, ignorance must be overcome by correct understanding. To arouse understanding, the mind must be concentrated, and so on down through the counter conditions, down to the gain of faith in the true Dhamma. This relationship is analogous to the relation between a guided missile and its mobile target. The missile does not reach its target merely through its own initial thrust and direction. It finds it precisely because it is being controlled by signals the target itself is emitting. Essentially what we're doing here, we're the missile here, and we are aiming in this direction, but not through our own efforts alone, but because we are getting signals from up here, the emancipation end of the cycle, and not really a cycle, the path to emancipation. And so we are being pushed by our own efforts, but we are also being led by a faith in the existence of this here, which is in turn kind of a magnetic pull for us down here. Right. Okay. It is the experience of suffering. Okay, as we make this detour, the experience of suffering, which first tears us out of our blind absorption in the immediacy of temporal being and sets us in search of a way to its transcendence. We will react to suffering in most cases in an unhealthy manner, as when we arouse resentment against the source of our displeasure and seek relief by annihilating it, ignoring it, or running away in pursuit of some easy escape. In the second case, we will react to suffering in a mentally healthy way, as when we fortify our minds with patience and courage, strengthen our capacities for endurance, and seek to resolve the problem in a realistic manner. The quest for a conclusive solution to the problem of suffering begins with an act of understanding, not with mere tribulation. It starts from the realization that suffering is more than a chance encroachment upon a state of affairs otherwise felicitous, that is a malady which infects our being upwards from its very roots. We must come to see the breeding ground of suffering lies not so much in the outside world as in the base of our own being, and that any cure that is to be permanently effective must uproot it at its inward source. Okay. Since it is suffering that impels us to seek the way to liberation, suffering is called the supporting condition for faith. So we're now getting back into supporting conditions. Faith is the second, the suffering, then arises faith. For faith to arise, two conditions are required. First is the awareness, and this is the other thing that we have to be remind ourselves of pretty constantly. We can distract ourselves from our own suffering, our own sense of the unsatisfactoriness of things, by acquisition, by even learning of, even education in a way is a way of solving problems that aren't the basic problem. You have to be aware that suffering is greater than the things that you immediately feel, like pain. The second thing is not getting the things you want. The third one is the most important one, and that is the fact that being human involves suffering. It has to do with the mystery that I referred to yesterday. We don't know what we're doing here. We don't understand the point of this circularity. So for faith to arise, two conditions are required. The first is the awareness of suffering, which makes us recognize the need for a liberative path. The second is the encounter with a teaching that proclaims a liberative faith. Thence the Buddha says that faith has for its nutriment in hearing the exposition of the true Dhamma. Now this kind of goes off this little thing, because this is a condition that isn't mentioned here. But to begin this, to establish any faith at all, it requires more than just kind of a blind faith. It needs to have something substantial toward which to aim, and that's what the Dhamma does. The Dhamma explains in a very logical way that there is a release and that we are all capable of it. So we need to encounter a teacher, we need to encounter a philosophy or a religion that seems to impel us in a correct direction. It's useful if you have a teacher. Sometimes you don't. That means you need to do a lot of reading, or just the correct reading. It helps to have a sangha in whom you have faith, whose judgment you trust. A great teacher helps, but they're not always available. And so you have to rely a lot on kind of on your own research and your own instincts about what feels right in here for you, that's going to get you beyond how you normally have been tackling your life. Okay. At the outset, there is required an acceptance. Oh yeah, okay. This is good, because at the beginning, you take on a teaching or a teacher, but you can't prove that it's right, because you don't have the knowledge and vision of things as they really are. You take it on Ajahn Chah-Sara refers to as trust rather than faith. You have to assume that you're not going to know what it is you're embarking on specifically. You have to assume that, I mean, that's what I've been doing for 15 years. I don't know any more than I did in the beginning, but I assume that these people aren't fools that are teaching me. They're not doing it for themselves. They're actually doing it for me. And it's difficult for materialists to accept this kind of thing, but I've managed to. And I think many of you are probably streets ahead of me in terms of faith, but it's an assumption that you're not being led astray. You're being led correctly. At the outset, there is required an acceptance which cannot be fully corroborated by objective evidence. It's the mobilizing force of action stirred up by the energy to actualize the ideal. Now, I've inserted in here wirya, which is energy, and between sada and pamoja, which is joy, you have to put in some effort. And effort is divided into four. There's only one real effort, and that is sort of putting your bottom on the floor and spending a lot of your life contemplating, or actually, no, firstly, getting into a state of one-pointedness so that your mind loses all of its discursive chatter that we spend most of our time experiencing. So it's the mobilizing force of action stirring up the energy to actualize the ideal. Prior to this discovery of the true Dhamma, two alternatives present themselves to the thoughtful individual. One alternative is compliant submission to a justification of suffering developed along traditional theological lines. This solution, a theodicy which sees evil and suffering as detracting from the goodness of the created order only superficially while ultimately contributing to the total perfection of the whole. This is what Christianity is really pretty much about, and I suppose Islam. The fact is there's an essential goodness going on, that all of this stuff is a mistake, and somehow or other we're going to be saved by our own pure faith and adherence to their particular belief system. The other alternative is resignation to suffering as a brute fact, unintelligible to man's moral sense, an incidental offshoot of a universe totally indifferent to any structure of spiritual or ethical values, which is essentially the nihilist approach. And that's where existentialism was kind of born. Neither theological nor materialistic answers can show the way to actual escape from suffering. Both in the last analysis can only hold out a choice between resignation and rebellion. Suffering from this perspective is traceable to distinct causes endowed with ethical significance. They are choices for which we bear full responsibility. And this is a thing that I spent a lot of time telling people. The fellow yesterday who's going through the tortures of the damned about he's disease-ridden and he's got a divorce coming up, etc. And I said, the answer doesn't lie out there. You're not going to fix your legal problems or your medical problems. Your answer lies in here and what you want to pay attention to. It has to do with attention. Every one of us, we're the creators of our own problems because the world presents us with certain situations, and it's what we do with this that determines how we react. And we can spend our whole lives suffering under perceptions of how the world should be. My brother's a right-wing fanatic, and he spends hours a day blogging on his right-wing stuff, and I send him occasionally emails saying, but how much influence do you have over this? He's got absolutely none, but he's just spending hours a day just seething. He's angry about the Islamization of Europe and it goes much deeper than that, but he's just full of hatred, and it's all from here. It's not from out there. He's found himself a target of convenience, and I just find it's really kind of, it's futile, but it's kind of poignant because it's such a waste of time. So the gain of faith in the true Dhamma, thus points to an outlet from the contention of opposed alternatives, neither of which can be happily embraced. It exhausts the pressures of an apparent dead end. Sustained reflection on the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha gradually dispels the darkness of doubt and indecision. The aspirant's faith creates a readiness to undertake the basic rules of moral training. So once you gain this faith and you put in some effort, that's when your five precepts begin to give you a template for how you should act to try and improve things so that you can carry on this upwards path. At this stage in particular, the aspirant's faith creates a readiness to undertake the basic rules of moral training. The observance of moral discipline, sila, for this reason, the acceptance of moral restraint is said to be undertaken out of faith. All of us will take the five precepts kind of as a ritual and don't really take it on as a living practice. I'm not to say that we all break them, but it's just that it seems to be kind of a rote thing that we recite. And it's far deeper than that, and it should be. It's the kind of thing that actually it impels us to keep the work going until we reach the next stage, which is joy. And the joy that comes from realizing one's purity confirms the confidence originally placed in the teaching. So what you've done then is, by continually maintaining your five precepts and looking back on how you've been acting, you do get a degree of joy. I mean, Ajahn Brahm stresses this a lot. He says that joy is Ajahn Jayasaro also says, you can't do without Pamoja. Pamoja is the thing that actually keeps you going. You can have all the faith in the world, but the thing that actually gives you a bit of a visceral boost is the joy that you get from knowing that you're kind of you're doing the right thing. And joy is the supporting condition for rapture. Now, this is piti. Though for certain individuals, serene faith in the objects of refuge and a clear conscience are sufficient to transfer joy into rapture, A further commitment to training is necessary for most people. This commitment takes the form of deliberate application of the practice of meditation. This is where we begin to actually put, we really begin to go to work. And this is where this is a graduation from the keeping of the five precepts, which are pretty much what a lot of people in Thailand even do. They keep the five precepts, but they don't do much meditation. I mean, in the rural areas, that's not true, strictly speaking. But certainly in the materialist capital of Bangkok, there's not much meditation being done. These people kind of they attempt to buy their way into heaven by going to the Dhammakais, and they don't, you know, meditation is very secondary. I mean, and that's why I find you people admirable. If you guys can meditate out here while you're paying a mortgage and raising the kids and all that, I just think it's admirable that you are able to maintain any kind of practice at all. I mean, I think I said yesterday that I don't think I'd be able to do it. So, yeah, congratulations on maintaining this. Starting your meditative practice, you take up some particular object, which is to get your mind one-pointed enough so that your distracting thoughts are allayed. After taking up one of these objects as a field of work, the practitioner strives to unify his mind by fixing his attention on his object to the exclusion of all sense data, concepts, thoughts, memories, projections, fantasies, and associative thinking. His aim is to make his mind one-pointed, and this forbids at once his dispersal amongst a multiplicity of concerns. And Ajahn Jayasaro often makes the point that here you are trying to concentrate on your breath or on metta or on the next stage on the path, something to get your mind on one point, when all the time there's 150 other things that seem equally interesting, and you've got this choice to make. Do I stick with one, which is kind of repetitive, or do I go on to all these other things that are so much more entertaining? So again, this relies on your faith in the practice. You have to eventually sort of give up the fun, although the fun will come, but the fun that you perceive is, again, a question of perverted perceptions of what fun really is. Where are we? The achievement, is an achievement of momentary concentration. As brief as it is, this gives immense satisfaction. It's a powerful experience, unleashing spurts of mental energy which flood up to the surface of consciousness and inundate the mind with waves of joyous refreshment. Now, any of you who have experienced PT, and I think a lot of people who have practiced for a long time, have had this rush. It's kind of the way junkies describe heroin. You get a rush. It's not exactly the same, but it's something that's kind of, it's outside your normal experience, and it's profoundly affecting. It's a spur to keep going, because a little bit of this is good, but a lot more would be a lot better. Once you get to this stage of PT, it's a bit rugged, though. It's because it's excitatory. And so the next stage is to get to is pasadi, which is tranquility. In its coarser modes, PT, rapture, still contain an element of exuberance, which is in constant danger of slipping out of control and spilling over into unwholesome states of mind dominated by restlessness and agitation. Through continued application to the practice, rapture becomes more refined, shedding the heated zest of its initial forms. With its refinement, it increasingly evokes along with itself another quality called tranquility. Tranquility is characterized by the quieting down of mental disturbances. Okay, you're a little quieter now. You've had your initial rush, which gives you a bit more confidence. And you can then sort of reach a state of relaxation for the time being. It gives you a chance to perhaps reflect on what it is that you've just been through. Tranquility, then, is the supporting condition for happiness. As your psychosomatic system is brought to a state of tranquil composure, a feeling of inner happiness or bliss, sukha, unobtrusively present from the start, gains in prominence until it emerges in its own right as a salient feature of the training. Rapture is relatively coarse in quality and happiness subtle. Thus, the rapture is always accompanied by happiness. In the higher meditative attainment of the third jhana, happiness can remain even after rapture has faded away. So again, this matrix that I was talking about, this isn't strictly linear. You can have piti, you can have happiness, you can actually have rapture. Sort of, you're reminded of this. It's something you don't lose each successive step. You don't lose a memory of it. And this is why when you sit again, you can't lose the memory of what's happened, because that's exactly what's going to spur you on to try and achieve that state again. You shouldn't be trying to get to the same state, but it reminds you that there is a state beyond which you are currently managing to get. Happiness is sometimes equated in the commentaries with something called access concentration. Sukha, as the happiness of the access to absorption, the term access, upachara, denotes the stage in the cultivation of serenity immediately preceding full absorption, the intended goal of serenity meditation. So, without delving too much into the commentaries, the practice of concentration on one of the prescribed objects of serenity meditation, that's also samadhi. Serenity meditation is equal samadhi, the attempt to reach a samadhi state. The practice of concentration is one of the prescribed objects of serenity meditation, inhibiting all the negatives in your head simultaneously. The latent defilements which are there, even though you are in a state of access concentration, they're still there. They're just waiting for a lapse of attention to reemerge. The latent defilements can crop up into the open only so long as the mind is driven by discursive thinking. The unification of the mind upon a single object closes off the portal through which they emerge. As the mind descends to increasingly deeper levels of concentration, the hindrances are gradually made to subside until, with the attainment of access, their suppression becomes complete, but not eternal. It's complete temporarily. Along with their disappearance, the mind passes beyond the stage of access and enters into absorption or full concentration. It's termed samadhi here. Ajahn Brahm would equate that with jhana. That's what we're talking about now. That's my own understanding of what he has to say. Concentration itself denotes a mental factor present in both attainments of access and absorption. Its salient feature is the wholesome unification of mind on a single object, and it brings about harmonization. And that's what you feel essentially once you get to a jhanic state, or even the somewhat lesser states of absorption. It's harmony. There are no discordant emotions, no discordant, don't like to use the word vibrations, but there aren't. You're in tune. You're completely in tune. Okay, again, he repeats, the waves of discursive thinking have at last subsided, and the mind abides without straying even the least from its base of stabilization. At the plane of absorption, concentration is then divided into four levels called four jhanas. Now, we're not going to go into that because we're going to run out of time, but I think we're all aware of the four jhanas. They're four states of increasing concentration. Concentration is a supporting condition for the knowledge and vision of the things as they really are. Now, once you get into apana samadhi, which is the highest form of jhana, despite the loftiness of sublimity of these exalted attainments, immersion in deep concentration is not the end of the Buddhist path. The unification of consciousness affected by serenity meditation is only a means to a further stage of practice. This stage, ushered in by the next link of the series, the knowledge and vision of things as they really are, Yata Buddha and Jnanadasana, which is just here. The ones I've just been describing work us this far. This is all the serenity meditation or the achievement of samadhi. With samadhi, you gain a knowledge of and vision of things as they are, but only through deep insight meditation. Release from suffering has yet to be achieved, for the latency of the defilements lying quietly in the mental continuum can still regenerate the samsaric round of continued birth and death. To destroy the defilements down to their bottommost stratum of latency, something more is needed, and that's panya. And panya is all we're after, which is way up here. From knowledge of things as they really are is the beginning of panya, and that leads on to dispassion, etc. To destroy the defilements down to their bottommost, panya is the, anyway, the Buddha enjoins his disciples to develop concentration not as an end in itself, but because one who is concentrated understands things as they really are. Ignorance signifies not so much the lack of specific pieces of information as a basic non-comprehension regarding the true nature of things as expressed in the Four Truths. So ignorance is not just information, is not just a lack of information, it's a basic incomprehension of what it is we're up against. Okay, where are we? Yeah, okay. To achieve this experiential understanding, it is necessary of the second system, the development of insight. The practice of insight meditation aims at dislodging the defilements by eradicating the ignorance at their base. In the discourse, the Buddha states that what must be known and seen as they are is the five aggregates. Now that's form, feeling, perception, consciousness. Where are we? Five aggregates. Form, feeling, perception. I'll get to it. Here we are. Material form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. Yeah, sankharas. They are the basic categories structuring the Buddha's analysis of experience. Now we all have these five. They're called khandhas, the five aggregates. And it's an analysis of these five a thoroughgoing, deep, heart-based analysis of these five, which you can only do when your mind is not thinking about other things. It's like putting life up to an X-ray machine or an MRI. It's seeing things genuinely. It's seeing things not through the perceptions that we have out here. It's a totally different mind state, and that's why it's so difficult to get to. We've got to go against everything we've been conditioned to think and do and feel. The assumption of permanent selfhood Buddhism holds to be the basic conceptual error. Now, all of these aggregates add up to what we call ourselves, but these aggregates are all conditioned by other things, and they can't exist on their own. They don't exist as possessions of this particular being. The five aggregates support in complete autonomy entirely through their reciprocal support, without need for self-subsistence, unifying principle to identify as a self or an object. These things carry on whether or not you have an idea of self, whether or not there is a self, they carry on. And by virtue of the teachings, we recognize that there isn't actually a particular individual separated self. These things carry on, kind of, as he says, in complete autonomy. With his mind made clear and pliant as a result of concentration, the practitioner attends diverse phenomena coming into the range of his awareness. Now that can be the khandhas for sure, but also you can contemplate any of the Four Noble Truths. You can contemplate, once you get into this insight meditation, that you can contemplate anything that arises in your mind and break it down into its constituent parts. The analytic procedure generates the realization that experience is just a double stream of material and mental events without a subsisting self. The synthetic procedure makes it clear that all these events are conditioned phenomena which arise when their conditions are present and cease when their conditions disappear. The next stage is the contemplation of rise and fall. That's when Ajahn says is the most important thing, is when you actually see things as they really are. You actually see them disappearing. Their appearance is apparently easy to see. Their disappearance and acknowledging their disappearance when it happens is the most difficult part. The impermanent, unsatisfied phenomena comprised in the five aggregates turn out to have a third characteristic, the aspect of selflessness. The realization of these three characteristics, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and selflessness, through unmediated insight is the knowledge and vision of the things as they really are. Once you get to this stage, you reach a stage called Nibbida, which is disenchantment. Ajahn Jayasaro likes the term, how do you call it? It's a state of sober sadness. Nibbida is often referred to as disgust, but it's not really that. It's just a tiring. It's a fatigue with how things appear to us. We not because we have something greater to see, because we haven't seen it yet, but we just weary. We weary of things, perceiving things as we always have. Right. The realization of these three characteristics through unmediated insight is knowledge and vision of these things as they really are. Okay. Disenchantment. It's the final phase of this process. Okay. Conditioned things are seen to be fraught with peril when adhered to with craving and wrong views. The mind was drawn to the world by the lure of promised gratification. Now, with the exposure of the underlying danger, it draws away from the direction of disengagement. This inward turning away from the procession of formations is called nibbida. Nibbida signifies, in short, the serene, dignified withdrawal from phenomena which supervenes when the illusion of their permanence, pleasure, and selfhood has been shattered by the light of correct knowledge and vision of things as they are. The words nibbida, actually the literal meaning of it is to find out. And it's a discovery that the things that you'd always believed in as being stable, you realize the falsity of it. Before the development of insight, the aggregates were regarded as mind, I, and self. Now, when illuminated with the light of insight knowledge, they are seen in the opposite way as not mind, not I, and not self. In place of the fascination and attraction, a profound experience of estrangement sets in. So estrangement would be as good a synonym for nibbida as disgust. In the trail of disenchantment, there arises a deep yearning for deliverance from the round of samsara, becoming, and there is a strong detachment and an evolving commitment and capacity for renunciation. And when you discover this stuff, you find out that there's a basis for the renunciation that we are all taught as good Buddhists, that is one of our primary goals is relinquishment, what Ajahn Brahm would call letting go. And that means letting go of everything, and including this. A new urge toward relinquishment is the one clearly perceived way to release. Driven by a longing for liberation, driven by the longing for liberation, a point is eventually reached where a fundamental turnabout takes place in the seat of consciousness, affecting a radical restructuring of the mental life. Now I did that. Whatever is there of material form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness, he turns his mind away from these phenomena, and when he has turned his mind away from them, he focuses his mind on the deathless element thinking. So this is what you finally focus on while within this jhanic state, and beyond that, you're getting into this vipassana. What you're doing is you turn your mind to the deathless state, which is what you're only two steps away from it now. He turns his mind away from these defilements, and when he has turned his mind away from them, he focuses his mind on the deathless element, thinking, this is peaceful, this is the sublime, that is, the stilling of all formations, the relinquishment of the foundations, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, and nibbana. Nibbana can only be attained by turning one's gaze towards samsara and scrutinizing it in all its darkness. This principle, that the understanding of the conditioned is the way to the unconditioned. Now, that's another thing. You can't simply ignore samsara. You have to pay attention to it and see its drawbacks. The supramundane consciousness that realizes nibbana during the Four Noble Truths, illuminating them all at once with startling clarity. Just, O monks, as a man in the gloom and the darkness of the night, at the sudden flashing up of lightning, should see with his eyes, recognize the objects, just so the monk sees according to reality. This is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the path leading to the cessation of suffering. So there's your Four Noble Truths. The moment of penetration, the eight mental factors comprised in the Noble Eightfold Path concurrently arise, performing the task of realization. Right view sees the unconditioned, etc. With the first path, the practitioner eradicates the first three fetters, personality view, doubt, and misapprehension of rules and observances. This is Sotapanna, of course. And now we are past nibbida into viraga, which is disenchantment, dispassion. Viraga is dispassion, and that's where we are right now. He becomes a stream enterer. Then there's the second path, the Sakadagami and Anagami. Now, emancipation, okay, no. Eliminating sensual desire and aversion by means of the third path, then in the end, he cuts off the remaining five fetters, desire for existence in the fine material and immaterial planes, conceit, restlessness, and ignorance. I've always found that one of the final fetters to be cut to become an arahant is restlessness. I thought restlessness is one of those things you got rid of a long time before that, but apparently not. Dispassion is a supporting condition for emancipation. Now, that's vimutti. Second to last, okay? The completion of the fourth path in fruition results in full emancipation. Through his complete eradication of the Four Noble Truths, the Arahant has eradicated ignorance and released his mind from the grip of the passions. The mind of the Arahant is at once impeccably pure through the absence of attachment and radiantly bright through the luminosity of wisdom. All right, okay. And he's completely pure until he passes beyond and he leaves his body behind, and up until then he's an arahant with residue remaining, it's called, and then he dies and then it's all over. And as a matter of fact, he doesn't really die, because by the time he gets there's nothing left to die. There's no more illusion of there being a being to die. This knowledge, certifying the abandonment of the defilements, arises immediately after the mind has been liberated from their grip by the full penetration of the Four Noble Truths. When it is liberated, the knowledge arises in him, it is liberated. And I find even this too personal, because it being a pronoun, I think it would be far better phrase is, there is liberation. Not it, me, I am liberated. There is liberation. And this, I believe, is a state wherein there aren't any pronouns. There's no subjectivity to it at all. It's an absolutely free and open. And I'm going to read you in a minute an experience a friend of mine just had in a meditation session, which expresses this beautifully. In the last stage is the retrospective cognition of release, involving two acts of ascertainment. The first is called the knowledge of destruction, and then there's the knowledge of non-arising. The two together are called the knowledge and vision of emancipation. The attainment of arahantship automatically generates a retrospective condition ascertaining the final abandonment of all defilements. Now, this is the thing I think is a little kind of extra, because once you're liberated and you say there is liberation, I wouldn't have thought to look back and go, oh, that's right, I'm liberated. It just seems kind of excessive. It doesn't seem necessary. Thence, by witnessing their utter eradication, he gains certainty of his emancipation from the round. Unshakable is my emancipation. This is my last birth. There is now no renewal of existence. Such knowledge remains an inalienable part of the Arahant's spiritual inheritance. So that's, in a very complicated form, this particular exposition of the path to liberation. And again, I like it because it gives us a way where I've never seen it in any other sutta. It gives you a specific, detailed way of getting out of it. And I would advise you to read it quietly by yourself, because I'm not much of an explainer. But I would like to read you this one thing, if I can find it, from this friend of mine. He's actually a Zen practitioner, and he sent me the other day a description of a state that he reached, and I found it interesting how he analyzed it. You have to bear with me a second. I seem to have lost it amongst all my notes. There we go. Okay. To Lungta. Dear Lungta, from time to time, and the time is not of my own choosing, without effort or invitation, a deep and blissful sense of peace descends that is tangible, powerful, spacious, full, complete in itself, and utterly palpable. It is felt and not seen or thought. In that powerful peace that I can only call presence, there is no sense that one could be other than that presence, and one is utterly complete in being just that. There is no second. There are no questions to be asked. There is nowhere else to be and nowhere else that one would want to be. It is utterly natural and self-fulfilling in every way, and yet it is completely all-embracing. Everything of the world goes on as usual, buildings, trees, people coming and going. Nothing is any different. Also, one can have thoughts in it. None of any of this interferes with or touches this presence. Sometimes it lasts for a half an hour, sometimes a few hours. It chooses, not me. He adds, too, I just could not find it described in your Buddhism, and I can't find it in my Zen at all. It's not being in the zone or some such bullshit. It's not a sudden kensho or awakening. No flash of lights. Nothing disappears into nothingness. No aha moment. No realization is one. It is not a void, and it is not a no-self experience. I'm, in fact, very much there. In fact, never more so. And I'm certainly neither awakened, enlightened, an arahant, or any other silly description. So it can be done any number of ways, but we've got a path, and he's managing to find his without following either his Zen method or ours. I've given him a lot of Ajahn Brahm's books, and he's enjoyed them, but he's had to find his own way. And I would suggest that as good as this is, despite how I presented it, it's not the only way. There is, as I said yesterday, my brother's a Russian Orthodox deacon, and he seems to have found, he hasn't found peace, but he's found a path that suits him. And I think all the paths that each of us take are determined by three things: karma, character, and conditioning. And over none of those things do we have any control. We've landed here in Buddhism by, not fate, but by karma, conditions, and our own character. And I could just, I remember saying to Ajahn Brahm once, that I became a Buddhist monk arbitrarily. And he said, not on your life. This is pure karma. So work with it as best you can. Say, this is an important sutta. It wasn't well presented, but pay attention to it. I think it gives you a template for graduating. So, bing. Thank you. Oh. We'll chant. We'll give a thanks to the Buddha. Haraham Samma Sambuddho Bhagava Bhutan Bhagavantan Abhivademi Sawakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang namasami Supatipanno bhagavato Sāvaka sangho Sanghaṃ namāmi Okay. So, good luck. What I'll do, actually, I don't need it anymore, so I'll leave that the exposition by Bhikkhu Bodhi, which is so detailed that I had to sort of pick bits out of it, but I'll leave it on the table back there, and you can at least get the link, and it's on BuddhaNet, and it has to do, I'll just leave the whole thing there. I think it's worth your while. I mean, it does what I tried to do, and it does it very well. Actually, here it is. I'll leave it there.